The Clinton presidency. The 8-year presidential term of Bill Clinton, a personable, articulate graduate of Yale Law School, a Rhodes Scholar, and former governor of Arkansas, began with a hope that a bright young person would bring to the country what he promised, change. But Clinton's presidency ended with no chance that it would, as he had wished, make his mark in history as one of the nation's great presidents. His last year in office was marked by sensational scandals surrounding his personal life. More important, he left no legacy of bold innovation in domestic policy or departure from traditional nationalist foreign policy. At home, he surrendered again and again to caution and conservatism, signing legislation that was more pleasing to the Republican Party and big business than to those Democrats who still recalled the bold programs of Franklin Roosevelt. Abroad, there were futile shows of military braggadocio and a subservience to what President Dwight Eisenhower had once warned against, the military-industrial complex. Clinton had barely won election both times. In 1992, with 45% of the voting population staying away from the polls, he only received 43% of the votes, the senior Bush getting 38%, while 19% of the voters showed their distaste for both parties by voting for a third-party candidate, Ross Perot. In 1996, with half the population not voting, Clinton won 49% of the votes against a lackluster Republican candidate, Robert Dole. There was a distinct absence of voter enthusiasm. One bumper sticker read, "If God had intended us to vote, he would have given us candidates." At his second inauguration ceremony, Clinton spoke of the nation at the edge of a new century in a new millennium. He said, "We need a new government for a new century." But Clinton's rhetoric was not matched by his performance. It happened that the inauguration coincided with a nationwide celebration of the birthday of Martin Luther King, Jr., and Clinton invoked King's name several times in his address. The two men, however, represented very different social philosophies. By the time King was assassinated in 1968, he had come to believe that our economic system was fundamentally unjust and needed radical transformation. He spoke of the evils of capitalism and asked for a radical redistribution of economic and political power. On the other hand, as major corporations gave money to the Democratic Party on an unprecedented scale, Clinton demonstrated clearly his total confidence in the market system and private enterprise. During his 1992 campaign, the chief executive officer of Martin Marietta Corporation, which held huge and lucrative government contracts for military production, noted, "I think the Democrats are moving more toward business, and business is moving more toward the Democrats." Martin Luther King's reaction to the buildup of military power had been the same as his reaction to the Vietnam War, where he had said, "This madness must cease." The evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together. Clinton was willing to recall King's dream of racial equality, but not his dream of a society rejecting violence. Even though the Soviet Union was no longer a military threat, he insisted that the United States must keep its armed forces dispersed around the globe, prepare for 2 regional wars, and maintain the military budget at Cold War levels. Despite his lofty rhetoric, Clinton showed in his 8 years in office that he, like other politicians, was more interested in electoral victory than in social change. To get more votes, he decided he must move the party closer to the center. This meant doing just enough for blacks, women, and working people to keep their support, while trying to win over white conservative voters with a program of toughness on crime, stern measures on welfare, and a strong military. Clinton in office followed this plan quite scrupulously. He made a few cabinet appointments that suggested support for labor and for social welfare programs, and appointed a black pro-labor man as head of the National Labor Relations Board. But his key appointments to the Treasury and Commerce Departments were wealthy corporate lawyers, and his foreign policy staff, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA, the National Security Advisor, were traditional players on the bipartisan Cold War team. Clinton appointed more people of color to government posts than his Republican predecessors, but if any prospective or actual appointees became too bold, Clinton abandoned them quickly. His Secretary of Commerce, Ronald Brown, who was killed in a plane crash, was black and a corporate lawyer, and Clinton was clearly pleased with him. On the other hand, Lonnie Guinier, a black legal scholar who was being considered for a job with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, was abandoned when conservatives objected to our strong ideas on matters of racial equality and voter representation. And when Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, a black, made the controversial suggestion that masturbation was a proper subject in sex education, Clinton asked her to resign. This was especially ironic, considering Clinton's later sexual adventures in the White House. He showed the same timidity in the two appointments he made to the Supreme Court, making sure that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer would be moderate enough to be acceptable to Republicans as well as to Democrats. He was not willing to fight for a strong liberal to follow in the footsteps of Thurgood Marshall or William Brennan, who had recently left the court. Breyer and Ginsburg both defended the constitutionality of capital punishment and upheld drastic restrictions on the use of habeas corpus. Both voted with the most conservative judges on the court to uphold what they considered a constitutional right of Boston's St. Patrick's Day parade organizers to exclude gay marchers. In choosing judges for the lower federal courts, Clinton showed himself no more likely to appoint liberals than the Republican Gerald Ford had in the 70s. According to a three-year study published in the Fordham Law Review in early 1996, Clinton's appointments made liberal decisions in less than half their cases. The New York Times noted that while Reagan and Bush had been willing to fight for judges who would reflect their philosophies, Mr. Clinton, in contrast, has been quick to drop judicial candidates if there is even a hint of controversy. Clinton was eager to show that he was tough on matters of law and order. Running for president in 1992, while still governor of Arkansas, he flew back to Arkansas to oversee the execution of a mentally retarded man on death row. And early in his administration, in April 1993, he and Attorney General Janet Reno approved an FBI attack on a group of religious zealots who were armed and ensconced in the building complex in Waco, Texas. Instead of waiting for negotiations to bring about a solution, the FBI attacked with rifle fire, tanks, and gas, resulting in a fire that swept through the compound, killing at least 86 men, women, and children. One of the few survivors of the Waco tragedy was David Thibodeau, who, in his book, A Place Called Waco, gives us a rare inside description of the human consequences of the government attack. Despite the fact that more than 30 women and children were crowded into the narrow concrete chamber at the base of the residential tower, the tank crashed into the ceiling, shoving chunks of broken concrete onto the people huddled below. 6 women and kids were immediately crushed by falling blocks. The rest were suffocated by the dust and gas vapors as the tank injected massive doses of CS directly into their windowless, unventilated shelter. The charred corpse of 6-year-old Star, David's oldest daughter. David Koresh was the leader of the religious sect. was found with her spine bent into a backward bow until her head almost touched her feet. Her muscles were contracted by the combined effect of the fire's heat and the cyanide in her body, a byproduct of CS gas suffocation. Clinton and Reno gave feeble excuses for what was clearly a reckless decision to launch a military attack on a group of men, women, and children. Reno at one time talked of children being molested, which was totally unsubstantiated, and even if true, could hardly justify the massacre that took place. As so often happens in cases where the government commits murder, the surviving victims were put on trial, with a judge overruling the request of the jury not to levy harsh sentences and ruling for imprisonment up to 40 years. Professor James Fife of Temple University, who taught criminal justice, said, "There is no FBI to investigate the FBI. There is no Justice Department to investigate the Justice Department." One of the people sentenced by the judge was Reynos Avram, who commented, "This nation is supposed to run under laws, not personal feelings. When you ignore the law, you sow the seeds of terrorism." This turned out to be a prophetic statement. Timothy McVeigh, who some years after the Waco tragedy was convicted of bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City, which cost 168 lives, had visited the Waco site twice. Later, according to an FBI affidavit, McVeigh was extremely agitated about the government's assault on Waco.